From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Berlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Growing up in Ghana, Meshack Asari loved to read, but the only books available were educational texts designed to teach English.
It began with there not being children's books or the kind that I would have loved as a child, and then being asked to illustrate a book for children. Now, how about also writing?
I'll talk with the winner of this year's NSK Neustadt Prize for Children's Literature. But first, Joshua Landis joins me for a discussion about Saudi Arabia's break in relations with Iran.
This imperils peace talks that America is trying to coach on Syria, which put for the first time Iran and Saudi Arabia into the same room.
These conversations are coming up, but the news is next. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat. Joshua Landis, we have to talk about the Middle East once again, first weekend of the new year, but always big news. Saudi Arabia executed this week a Shiite cleric, along with a number of others, Sunni jihadists. But this is what made the news because of their tensions with Iran, because of the obviously the Sunni Shia, you know, sectarian violence that's going on. People seem to couch it in those terms, but perhaps there's something more going on here. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened and what might be behind this?
Well, and Saudi Arabia cut relations with Iran because Iran, as a result of the execution of this Shiite cleric, allowed a big mob to attack the Saudi embassy in Tehran. Saudi Arabia immediately cut relations, and a bunch of other Gulf states did. The Arab Emirates, Bahrain, so forth, cut relations with Saudi Arabia. So this imperils peace talks that America is trying to coach on Syria, which put for the first time Iran and Saudi Arabia into the same room. Who was this cleric? Nimr al-Nimr. The name means tiger, tiger. He had been an outspoken Shiite cleric. At the beginning of the Arab Spring, 2010-11, he had rallied Shiite crowds that demonstrated in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. That's the oil province. 15% of Saudis are Shiites. They have been discriminated against and they're angry. Big demonstrations broke out during the Arab Spring. They were calling death to the Saudi family and so forth. So it was very incendiary. And this cleric had a prominent role in those. He has openly asked for secession of the eastern provinces, which have all the oil, from Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis saw this as, we cannot let this kind of a cleric continue to speak out. Now, and they did, as you brought up, they did execute 43 Sunni terrorists who had been involved with al-Qaeda and had blown things up in Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis say, hey, we're just keeping the kingdom safe. This is all about national security. We're killing more Sunnis than we did Shiites, but you cannot go around demanding secession.
But there also seems to be another domestic political element to this too in Saudi Arabia, doesn't there? That it's not just the Sunni versus Shia, but that Saudi Arabia has been very engaged with the United States and others in fighting ISIS, a Sunni organization. And so there's been some internal struggle or criticism of the Saudi regime for that reason. And so maybe they're reaching out and saying, hey, look, we're actually not just fighting Sunnis out there around the world that are causing trouble, but we're actually still focused on Iran and the Shiite problem.
Saudi Arabia is using sectarianism. The war in Yemen is going badly. Prices of oil have collapsed.
How this relates to the price of oil is really interesting.
It is important, and it's important. Saudi Arabia ran a deficit of $100 billion last year, and because oil is at $35 a barrel, and there's a lot of internal criticism. So, in a sense, by inflaming nationalism, religious nationalism, this is going to shore up domestic
support within Saudi Arabia, which is struggling because of this oil crisis, if you will, in the terms of the price. So they're producing more. We're producing more. Iran is going to start producing more. Russia's producing more. Everybody's producing more, which, of course, is not, making the price of oil go up. It's having a
trade-off. It's going to create more pain for these oil-producing countries. And you're right. We would have expected that the price of oil would have shot up after this.
Because of these tensions, right? That's usually what happens. These tensions happen and prices of oil go up.
And that's largely because of China, because contemporaneous with this was the shuddering Chinese stock market and declarations that industrial production was falling in China, or at least was moving down below around 6% instead of 10, 11% as it had been. So this stock market collapse and fears has caused oil prices to collapse because it means demand is going to go down. And the whole world, and of course, Oklahomans are watching this and very anxious as well.
Well, Joshua, I think this is this case, again, is a reminder that we can't just look at what's going on in the Middle East from that any one perspective, that it's religious or political, but definitely economic and global in nature. So, yes, the importance of worldviews. Thank you so much, Joshua, as always, for being here.
It's a pleasure talking with you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or follow us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, at Suzette Grelot, and at Joshua_Landis. You can also download this program directly from our website or subscribe to it as a podcast in iTunes. After a short break, I'll talk with Meshack Asare. He's a children's book author from Ghana who just won the 2015 NSK Newstat Prize for Children's Literature. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. My guest today is Meshack Asare. He's a prolific children's author and just won the 2015 NSK Newstat Prize for Children's Literature. He published his first book 45 years ago, which won the Ghana National Book Award and a citation for Best Picture Book from Africa from the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO. He's also the focus of the January issue of the magazine World Literature Today, which is currently on newsstands. Meshack Asare, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, Meshack, I want to congratulate you on winning the 2015 NSK Newstat Prize for Children's Literature. And so I wanted to start just by asking you, since this is an award for children's literature, and you've obviously written a number of children's books, kind of what drew you to writing children's books? Because you're not only a writer, you're an illustrator as well. And so what drew you to that area of literature?
Well, it started when I was a child myself, actually. I quite often saw my own father reading. He loved to read. I think I was lucky in that sense. He had magazines and books, history books usually. But there weren't books for children. And I also realized some of the magazines that he had pictures in them, colored pictures especially. But there wasn't anything like that, except school textbooks when I started school. And those books were actually textbooks meant for you to learn to read English and write, and were not as interesting. What actually drew me into writing for children, finally, I studied art. So now I'm studying art. How about writing? Trying also to write so that I can make books for children. So that is actually how it initially came, you know, together and drew my attention to. It began with there not being children's books or the kinds that I would have loved as a child, and then being asked to illustrate a book for children. And that I had studied art, now I'm able to draw. Now how about also writing, you know, combining these with the aim to produce a really beautiful book. And that's how it started.
So you mentioned you're from Ghana. That's where you're born and raised. And so do you have a bit of a tradition there in terms of if you didn't have children's books, you told stories. Did you didn't have anything to read necessarily, but I presume that, I mean, you sound like your father was a reader, so that you had those around who perhaps told you stories. And was your ambition perhaps to take some of these stories that you know, these kind of, you know, lessons, if you will, and I'm going to get to your book that you won for, because I think there's some lessons in that book, but lessons that were perhaps told orally and then put them down on paper and to provide them for children with mm-hmm. pictures, with mm-hmm. illustrations. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That only came later, but it is true. It's a fact that I had and enjoyed a lot of stories, folk tales, actually, not from reading mainly, but from actually hearing these told by my grandparents. I was lucky again, because they knew a lot of these stories, and they visited from the villages, and I think most of the stories telling was actually done, you know, in the villages and farming villages, not in the towns and in the cities. But they visited us quite often, and it was storytelling time whenever they were there. But despite that, when I actually decided to try and write for children, I was more interested in showing, you know, children in the form of a book that also was about them, in environments that they actually could recognize that, yes, that is this, and that is this beach, and that is a canoe, and, you know, something that was very close to them, and they could realize that they could also see themselves playing roles and engaging in activities that they were familiar in. And I think I was actually comparing, you know, that possibility to the sort of books that we got from the UK, for example, about Jack and Jill, you know, about Snow, this and that, you know, doing things that they were quite familiar with. That is actually where, you know, I started. It was my first main, you know, engagement. Was that part of the identity, you know, where I am and what I am and what I do. And it was the beginning, and I think it came out in that first book called Terrier Goes to Sea, which was published in 1970. And it went on after that. It was much later, I think, the third or fourth book that I switched to the folk tales.
I'm talking with Meshack Asare, a children's book author from Ghana, who just won the 2015 NSK Newstat Prize for Children's Literature. You can watch a video of him describing some of his writing and illustrations on our website, kgou.org. We'll hear more of our conversation after a break. I'm Suzette Gourlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gourlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I've been talking with Meshack Asare, a children's author from Ghana, who's the winner of the 2015 NSK Newstat Prize for Children's Literature. Just before the break, he told me his greatest inspiration came from stories he could identify with about children engaging in activities that were familiar to him. I like that you raised the term identity, and that your purpose was to create something that would allow children to identify with their environment, and that even though it's fiction, it's a made up story, perhaps it's still relevant to them, and that they can identify with it. Well, the book that is being honored now, Kwadjo and the Brassman's Secret, this is a very interesting book where you're kind of teaching a lesson about choosing kind of wisdom over a temptation to become rich. So not only something that children can identify with, but perhaps an important lesson for them to learn. Can you tell us a little bit about that story in that book, and where did that come from? Why write about wisdom over riches?
Well, it has its roots in, or the feeling, strong feeling again, that if we already knew about something, It also helped us to add to it that we could learn, you know, and add more based on what we already knew. But I was growing up, and I had a chance to visit my grandmother living far away somewhere in another part of the, and saw men, you know, making, producing these figures, these gold weights, and was quite interested in how they made them initially, that the technical or technicalities of it, you know, that they took clay and made it into this, and then took wax and actually modeled the wax into figures, and finally turning it into metal. That was quite fascinating in itself. But it was not enough because they only produced them to sell. They weren't interested in... But I knew that these figures were not just made for no reason, okay? That they meant something. Each of them had a meaning. It told, some of them actually told entire stories. So then why were these men making them only to sell when people didn't even know what they actually mean anymore? That was a question initially, and then it went further to asking myself, why don't I too know what all of these wonderful figures mean, and from then on, I think it became an obsession. I actually got myself a collection, you know, so that I could hold and twiddle my hands and. And then I learned more and realized what they meant, that they were made for a purpose, for specific purpose of measuring, weighing gold dust, which was the currency of the time, you know. But it just accumulated over the years into several thousand, actually, okay. And then I imagine, well, so it means if you have all of these different bits and pieces together, the little figurines, you have entire stories, entire histories, entire proverbs, and plenty of them. And then it became useful, the importance and the value of it, you know, got heavier in my mind and also clearer that, yes, this is something to actually know about, there's something to learn about. The part of it telling about knowledge over money, let's say, okay, that was just part of it. Because some of the figures actually were telling proverbs about things that were not sensible to do, like carrying gunpowder and smoking, for example, and also like trying to do everything all by yourself, you know, a man scraping the bark of trees to make medicine, for example, that he couldn't expect to be able to gather it all, you know, some would drop on the things like that. And from this, it just came that, okay, how about getting a story, creating a story in which this boy, the main character, protagonist, would have to solve, you know, a puzzle, something at the end of which he could be rewarded. It was just the necessity of creating a plot, and then it resulted in that wonderful, you know, moral.
Yeah, I was going to say the lesson, the moral of the story. Yeah, every story has a point. There's some sort of moral you're learning from that story. But digging a little deeper behind something that was purely meant for commerce and looking at kind of the lessons and the, or the understanding that can come from that, the wisdom that can come from that, yeah. Well, so, Meshach, just very quickly, I have to ask you, I mean, obviously being from Africa, and you mentioned that there, you know, wasn't, at least during your childhood, much in the way of children's literature. I mean, what are the struggles that African authors face today? I mean, do you see a real growth in the in literature, in the field of literature, in countries around Africa, very big and diverse continent, obviously. Are there any kind of, you know, places where authors still struggle to get their work out? Or is the internet and the way in which we can connect today really providing a lot of outlet for African authors today?
Well, I think in one sense things have improved in the sense that through the media and new technology, you know, that African people now hear about African writers. I think most recognition that African writers receive today are still from outside, from abroad, rather than people are still not readers, don't have the reading culture, you know, is not as developed or as robust as, you know, in the West. Very few people still actually buy books. They rather would sit and watch the television and hear, you know, the news and things like that. And again, I think people are still poor, and they would buy, or if they had the money, they would spend it on a book which would enable their children to pass the common entrance examination and maybe get a scholarship or things like that. They've still faced the difficulty, and then all the boundaries, you know, the French on one side and the Portuguese on one side. I don't think publishers are able to produce and sell, you know, across Africa as it should be possible to do in Europe and in America, for example. So the boundaries are still there. The constraints still exist, and it impacts on writing and on authors. Still, it hasn't changed by that much, except, of course, as I said initially, the digital, you know, possibilities enable writers, African writers, to be heard about much more around the world than before.
Well, very interesting, Meshack. Thank you so much for being here. We all look forward to reading your work. And again, congratulations on your award. You've been listening to my conversation with Meshack Asare. He's a children's book author from Ghana who won the 2015 NSK Newstat Prize for Children's Literature. He's also featured in the January issue of the magazine World Literature Today. And you can find a link to an essay he wrote on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Brian Hardzinski produces the show and oversees our digital content with assistance from Sam Dupre. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Guerlotte.